Up next, we're going to talk about ESP wars, East and West, and account of the military use of psychic espionage. And this affects you. We'll be back in a moment with two special guests on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Two special guests for you tonight. First of all, Lloyd Auerbach back with us, Director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations, President of the Forever Family Foundation. He's one of the world's leading experts on psychic experience and ghosts. Lloyd has been investigating, researching the unusual for more than 34 years. A graduate degree in parapsychology. He's been teaching courses on the subject since 81. He is a professional mentalist and psychic entertainer as well, performing as Professor Paranormal, a title that follows him into his more serious work as well. Lloyd Auerbach, back on Coast to Coast. Lloyd, always a pleasure.
Thanks very much, George. Good to be here.
Looking forward to this. And Ed May is with us. Ed is a PhD, internationally known for his work in parapsychology, currently the executive director of the Cognitive Sciences Laboratory. Dr. May spent a year researching psychic phenomena with yogis in India and worked starting in 1976 at the government-sponsored SRI International. Ed, it's a pleasure to have you with us, too.
Well, thanks, George. It's good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
And I think this is your first time on Coast to Coast, isn't it?
I was thinking while waiting to hear you all this evening. I think I was quite some time, a number of years ago, but it hasn't been recently.
Long, long, long time ago. Well, good. I'm glad you're with us. And Lloyd, how have you been? What's new with you?
Well, this book is new, but otherwise just been kind of keeping up with teaching and trying to do some new projects for the Forever Family Foundation as well.
Well, good for you. And Ed, tell us a little bit about your association with Lloyd. How did that all happen?
Well, I think Lloyd and I have known each other since probably the late 80s or sometime even perhaps before that. We live in the Bay Area of San Francisco, so nowadays we get to see each other from time to time for lunch, and we've cooperated on this particular book on ESP wars. But we've been friends for a really long time and share common interests and many other things as well.
Well, both of you, just feel free to jump in at any time as we discuss this incredible work, ESP Wars. Now, Lloyd, of course, you are known quite well for your work on psychic experience and ghosts. Tell me about this evolution into ESP Wars, about the military for you.
Well, it's something I've certainly always been interested in. You know, I'm kind of more, even though I'm known for the ghost material, the ghost work that I've done in the investigations, I've been an educator in parapsychology since the very early 80s, in fact, since about 82. And so I've been interested in all aspects of ESP research and application of possible psychic abilities, and met and worked with some psychics and remote viewers over the years. So for me, this is not even an evolution. It's really kind of a culmination of an interest that I've had. I've definitely been interested in this subject, and ever since, I guess, 95, when it came out that the Stargate Project even existed, I got even more interested in this. And Ed invited me in this project to work on the book, and that was a major thing for me.
Fantastic. And Ed, of course, your work, how did you get started in all of this?
I'm sorry?
How did you get started in this work on ESP?
Well, oddly enough, my PhD is in nuclear physics, and after my degree, I had a three-year appointment at the University of California at Davis working in straight nuclear physics, and I'd never heard of ESP. I hadn't even heard of anything being psychic in those days, and I went to a conference that was held at UC Davis, because I had nothing else to do on the weekend, and it was all about extrasensory perception, and frankly, I thought this was all nonsense. I mean, how could this possibly be? I'm a physicist. These things were impossible to really work, so I thought it was crazy and sort of dismissed it. And about a year later, I was down at UC Berkeley doing some work in the Bay Area, and there was a flyer to go hear a talk by a guy named Charles Honerton, and again, on ESP. I thought, oh, well, they'll give it a second chance. So I went and listened to this guy, and oh, my goodness, he was talking straight science, you know, and that really appealed to me. So I invited Chuck out for dinner, and that started a lengthy collaboration, and in 1974, or rather 75, I worked in his laboratory studying ESP, And it became clear to me that there really is something going on, and how could I not be interested in it? After all, physics people are interested in how the world works, and this is some part, maybe a minor part, who knows, that were, you know, basically overlooked by physics. And so that's how I got into it. I was spent a year in India, as you mentioned earlier on in the introduction, chasing miracles, quote, in India,
yeah.
And found, frankly, none. And when I came back to work in New York City with Chuck Honerton in the laboratory there, and lo and behold, I saw all kinds of stuff I just could not explain. Then I ran into a fellow by the name of Ingo Swann, the late Ingo Swann, a very well-known psychic of some renown, and he invited me to join the team at SRI. And I thought, really? There's government work going on? And I joined SRI in 1975, late that year, as a consultant, and then eventually became a senior research physicist with those guys. And in 1985, I became the director of what's now known as Stargate, at least the research part of it.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I'm wondering if you came across, because Ingo was very close with her, my aunt, Dr. Shafika Karegula, in those days. Did you have any dealings with her?
No, I knew of her. Ingo mentioned her, but I never had the pleasure of meeting her.
Yeah, she was a psychiatrist and literally changed her entire practice to cover ESP and psychic phenomena. She was so into it, she just said, yeah. I'm not going to be a psychiatrist anymore. I'm going to use my medical degree, and I'm going to study this. And she did. She wrote a book called Breakthrough to Creativity, and, I mean, she was really, really into it, and tragically died right in the middle of most of her research. Go figure, right? But she, I think she was on the cutting edge of some incredible things, as you both have been.
As Lloyd will tell you, passing away is not necessarily the end of your research career.
That's right.
No, that's true. They just got to get it back to us somehow.
Exactly.
Lloyd, in your case, of course, you know, we as a United States got into this when the Soviets were doing their psychic programs.
Right.
How much of that were you aware of? Because, again, you're expert on psychic experience and ghosts.
Yeah.
But did you know about what was going on there in the military?
Well, I certainly had suspicions. And you know, we not only was there, of course, the classified work in remote viewing, there was the more public work research that was going on. So I was very, very well aware of that. Was happening, but there were suspicions of several of our of the folks in our field, even as far back as I recall in 1981, there was a conference that was convened by a very rich individual, or seemingly rich individual, who supposedly made his money with a psychic finding oil wells, and it all seemed very suspicious, so we were actually even wondering how much of that might have been connected. But we knew about Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff's work at SRI, and there was a lot of suspicion around how much of what was going on was actually not being shared with us, that there might have been some activity with remote viewing in other areas that were hidden from what parapsychologists were being told about.
In those days, we spent an awful lot of effort to keep our program, to use the jargon of the day, low profile.
Mm-hmm.
That meant hardly anybody at SRI. In fact, we had what was called a special access program. Even though most of the work was at the classification level of secret, some top secret, but most of it was secret. But even if you were the president of the United States, if you weren't on the special list, called a special access list, you could not even know about what we were doing.
That's amazing.
Very, very well protected.
You know,
sure, there were
some
lots of rumors running around, but you know, most of what we did, in fact, even still to today, most of what happened on that project still remains sensitive and secret.
Some people say the program's still going on, Ed. I don't know, because most of you great remote viewers and researchers aren't doing it anymore, at least with the military. Do you think, though, they still have a program going on?
Well, I guess the short answer to that is no. The longer answer is no, but I sure wish they were. At this time, and with the world politics and threats that are running around, it would be useful. The reason I'm suspicious that they're not is that during our time with the government, it was not a popular program within the government. In fact, the government people tried everything they could possibly do to put us out of money, shut us down in all possible ways. And except for a handful of heroes, and I'm sorry to say I can't mention most of their names right now, the fact is that they stood in between our project and the detractors who wanted to shut us down. And basically, George, as a postscript to that, when we became friends with our former enemies in the Soviet Union, those guys had the exact same problem that we had. So they were using us to keep their funding going, and we were using them to keep our funding going.
Ed, are you convinced that the work that everybody did at SRI worked, that whatever was happening, it was real?
Well, I guess the short answer to that one is an easy one. Some people think that the government wastes their money, and probably there are plenty of cases where that's true. But let me tell you, the government would not have spent $20 million spread out over 20-plus years if they weren't getting some return on their investment.
I agree. And Lloyd, as you got into the work, ESP Wars, the book, mm-hmm. did you uncover anything that you didn't expect?
Well, yeah, there were actually a number of things, even as Ed and I talked a little bit about what went on with the project as the project ended, and as he and Joe McMonagle were trying to kind of get either resurrect the project or keep it going, just how much resistance they ran into due to the giggle factor, which has become the woo-woo factor, as you know, from people like the skeptics and such. And that's one of the reasons why it's probably not going on, at least not in any sanctioned way. There are just too many people in the political world who would just back off. They'd have a real problem. Let's put it this way, with their constituency, even if it was a secret project right now. And on that side, it was a little bit of there were some stories about, as Ed told us about, someone that was connected to the project that was actually a bit of a nightmare working with everybody else, and consequently, that was a problem of trying to get it resurrected. And then for me, a lot of the surprises came from the Soviets, from the Russians, the former Soviets, about what had gone on in the 70s and 80s.
Were there some pretty remarkable hits in terms of discoveries?
Well, certainly a lot of what we've got in the book are some really extremely good examples of hits by Joe McMonagle and Angela Ford. And mm-hmm. there's some really interesting hits discussed by some of the Russians in here. But for me, the revelations were about what the Russians had, let's just put it this way, what we had been told or what we had seen in books like Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain and other sources that came out in the 70s and 80s, not being exactly, it wasn't propaganda per se, because it might have been a little misinformation that they were presenting to keep their funding flowing, but there was certainly a lot of bad information in those books, things that had not really gone on. Successes that the Russians supposedly had with psychotronic weaponry and generators really didn't happen. And the politics of how their programs even continued in connection with the KGB were pretty interesting to me.
How about you, Ed? Any surprises doing the book?
Well, over the years, I first went to Moscow in 1992, just shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I traveled with the late Larissa Belenskaya, also known as Laura of Faith. And we traveled around for two or three visits to Russia, including out to Novosibirsk and in the Moscow area as well. And we were not meeting any of the military at that time for those first couple of trips. And then slowly, as we were traveling back and forth to Moscow, General Alexei Yurovich Savin, who we write about quite a bit in the book, made some tentative contacts to us, and we met privately with him, and he was still in the military, a very senior general, and we never met him in uniform. It was always private, either in his office or at a restaurant somewhere, and it finally became known that he was the director of their psychic program. At one time, they had 120 remote viewers. And then over the years, he retired, and I suggested to Alexei that we write this book together. And that's what started it all. And we ended up meeting KGB people. And as you may have seen in ESP Wars, the foreword was written by what's called the first deputy of KGB. That's the chap in second in command of the whole KGB in 1992 or 1990 time frame, somewhere in there. And his name is Nikolai Shom. And he said, you know, we funded 40 research institutes all over the Soviet Union, large sums of money, to develop PK weaponry called psychotronic weaponry. And he says, you know, it didn't work. And I laughed and I said, hey, Shyam, had it worked, you guys would have won the Cold War.
And there's
that
no question about it. Do you think the Soviets, Ed, got into this primarily because of warfare? That's what they wanted to do?
No doubt. That's exactly what it was up to. It was not warfare per se. Even the psychotronic weaponry was what's called non-lethal weaponry. Could they get a psychic or a gadget in Moscow to make Ronald Reagan feel sick to his stomach at a critical time in negotiations?
Right.
That sort of thing. It wasn't a lethal weaponry.
What about you trying to enter people's dream state to kill them? What do you think of that?
Well, there are lots of reports of that. I have no firsthand evidence that they actually tried that.
Lloyd,
not really. You know, the biggest problem with that is that if somebody is successful, how would we actually know that that they were killed by someone entering the dream state?
Unless
their ghost came back to us afterwards.
Yeah. You know, so many people die in their sleep. I've always wondered if they were having a nightmare and they just died of a heart attack because of the dream. But you're right. Who would know?
Yeah. You know, there's that statement about dreams that if you have a falling dream, if you hit the ground in the dream, you're going to die.
You're going to die, yeah.
And having had many of those dreams, you know, I grew up on Looney Tunes cartoons, so I never have to worry about dying if I hit the ground. I get out of the
Lloyd. Aren't you a ghost?
No, I just get out of a Lloyd-shaped hole at that point. But, you know, if somebody actually died in their sleep because of that kind of dream, their ghost would have to come back and tell us because there'd be no way for us to know otherwise.
That is so true.
That's one of the reasons we didn't invite Lloyd to be a ghost writer in this book.
Yeah, he would have. That's not bad, Ed, by the way. That's pretty good. Now, you've known Lloyd, Ed, for a long, long time. As you began to learn more and more about the Stargate program, I mean, were you surprised that we were doing this?
Could you repeat that, George? I think I may have missed part.
And this is for Lloyd primarily. You know,
When
you got involved in this, were you surprised?
Yeah, but of course, when I was involved in it, the program had already ended and had become publicly known in the mid '90s. So I got involved in this book a couple years ago, and consequently knew that the program had existed. I'd seen certainly seen Ed's appearance on Nightline, and seen other people talking about it. And there've been a number of the extra remote viewers from Stargate and previous projects who have been out there in the world teaching classes and lecturing here and there, everybody from Joe McMonagle to Lynn Buchanan, and there's been a number of other folks that I've met over the years. So I knew a little bit about the project itself, you know, what the specific tasks or missions that they were given. That's something that, you know, we have a few of those in the book, but as Ed mentioned, there's a bunch that I still certainly don't know about. He does, but I certainly don't know about.
Ed, was there anything that went wrong with the work we were doing for the military? I mean, was there anything that backfired on us?
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything that backfired, but not everything was successful. I would say roughly 20% of all the tasking that we were given by the intelligence communities worked. But that's remarkable. In fact, that's about the same level of accuracy that the old World War II spies used to do, creeping around on the ground in World War II. There's a special name for that called HUMINT, H-U-M-I-N-T, meaning human gathered intelligence. There are all kinds of other ints, like FOTINT, satellite photographs, and SIGINT, signal intelligence from NSA, and so on. And it turns out that the ESP kind of gathering of intelligence for the military is about as good and, frankly, as bad as human. I mean, you have a spy creeping on the ground, everybody thinks, oh, that's a great way to gather intelligence. Well, actually, it's not very good because we get faked out by looking at things. I mean, there was a very famous case in World War II where the Allies in Britain set up a fake attack with Patton. And they had rubber tanks and all kinds of things like that, and allowed the Germans to fly over this in a particular direction to convince them misinformation that something was going on. So human is not a good way of gathering information.
No. Ed, stay with us. And Lloyd, we're going to come back with more. And welcome back, Lloyd. Our back with us and Ed May. We're talking about their work, ESP Wars. Lloyd, let's talk a little bit about just the psychic experience that you've done over the last 34-plus years of investigating this. What have you concluded, Lloyd, about what this might be and how this works?
Well, definitely, we have some faculty, some form of perception, and I don't, you know, it doesn't seem to rely on the strictly, to me, biological basis of the brain. There's something a little bit more than what we consider the brain now. I'm not saying that we're not going to find out more about it later on, but there seems to be that human beings have the ability to perceive information beyond the reach of the senses. There's a new model that. Relatively new model that Jim Carpenter, who's the current president of the Parapsychological Association, put together in his book called First Sight last year, which suggests that ESP is not just second sight, it's really first sight. It's actually scanning the environment before we even bring in any of the normal senses at all, and that on occasion we have information that kind of pops up either when we need it or when it's, for whatever reason, just loud enough, you might say, a little kind of bright enough. I've learned that everybody has these experiences throughout their life, not consistently, certainly. People have different levels of experience. People have different aptitudes, it seems, for different psychic abilities. And it just, that this stuff's not paranormal at all. If you go by the numbers of people who've had these experiences, and even the people who claim on the one hand that they've never had an experience and then pull me and my colleagues aside when they meet us at cocktail parties or other kinds of parties and tell us all about their experiences, it's pretty clear that the majority of human beings have had some form of ESP experience, and it's a very normal thing, not a paranormal one at all. The how it works, I don't know that we're there yet in physics and biology, you know, neurology. I think we still have a little bit to learn. And the sad thing is that parapsychologists are kind of like out there in the middle of nowhere on their own because right. of the academic prejudice and the lack of funding. So we need people from other fields to look at this question of why people have these experiences and what they actually are. We can't just do it alone.
I think since we lost J.B. Ryan and Duke University's support on this, no real institution has picked up on this, have they?
Well, I mean, that was 1965 when Ryan retired from Duke.
Yeah, a long time ago.
A really long time ago. And there have been other institutions that have picked up on it a little bit. Certainly the federal government has. As we've seen, but it's, you know, compared to the amount of research money and personnel that go into other fields, even into single research projects for other fields, this is such a drop in the bucket. Even the Stargate project was such a drop in the bucket compared to other things. Even within psychology, it's just kind of absurd that most of science overtly states that these things are not possible, so why bother studying them? And yet they're not looking at the question of why people have these experiences, which are happening.
But, George, let me jump in here a moment.
Sure.
A lot has happened since the J.B. Ryan days. For example, you may have heard of the Russian novelist Arthur Koestler from Hungary. When he passed away, he bequeathed a rather large sum of money to the University of Edinburgh in Scotland to set up a division within the psychology department there to research parapsychology. And a worldwide search went out to find the first occupier of that professorship at the University of Edinburgh. And it turned out an American one by the name of Dr. Robert Morris, Bob Morris. And he moved to Edinburgh, and for the next 17 years, ran what's called the ESP, the Koestler Unit, at Edinburgh, and spawned approximately, 50 or so PhD-level people trained in research parapsychology that fanned out across the UK and across the rest of Europe. So right now, in the UK, it's a vibrant activity at many of the universities. You can take courses in ESP and parapsychology research. You can get master's degree and, in some cases, even PhD degrees in those fields. In the U.S., there was a fair number of universities. Syracuse University had a group. University of California at Santa Barbara had a group. I think our program at SRI and later at Science Applications International Corporation was a huge effort. The Ryan Center was still doing some work down there, but after J.B. passed away, it was never a major center compared to research. It was a good educational center and so on. Right at the moment, with a couple of places in the U.S. now, it's pretty much, I wouldn't say dead, but not particularly active compared to Europe. But at least it's alive and well in Europe, and it used to be, it's no longer, it used to be very vibrant at the university, at Moscow State University in Russia.
Well, and the key word that you used there, Ed, was had. You mentioned a lot of these universities had. They're not doing it anymore. How come?
In the U.S., well, there's a lot of, as Lloyd mentioned a while back, there's a lot of academic negativity with regard to this area. People decide that it's all crazy, and if the only thing that you know about ESP is what you read on or see in the movies or on TV, those shows are more about sort of sensationalizing what's going on and are less interested in the physics. I want to jump off a little bit more about what Lloyd had to say. Actually, there is some physical models that are beginning to show a glimmer of hope of how this might work. It's certainly beyond the six senses that we do know about, but I'm a bit at odds with the rest of my pals in this field, as I think eventually when we understand how all this works, it'll be understood in terms of physics, physiology, psychology, and other aspects of human sciences with slight extensions of what we already know. Oddly enough, there's even some physics models that look like it might be able to explain what we're seeing.
Lloyd,
I think a number of people in our field don't have a problem with that. We don't know what the model is going to look like, and it may put us all out of work at some level. But considering the parapsychology is sort of negatively defined as these experiences that are not currently explained by science today, once we understand them, they may fall into these other categories. They certainly will extend the models or what our understanding of human beings is in all of those fields, and I think that's a justifiable reason to be doing the research.
This ESP ability that seems to be inherent in us, do you think that it's a natural sense that's part of our body, or is it something supernatural that trained people tap into?
I think it's totally something natural. If you look across human talent, whether you're a good high jumper, a fast runner, or play magnificent violin or so on, there's quite a wide range of abilities that people have, let's say, in violin playing. Virtually everybody can make a squawk or something or even some recognizable music on a violin. I'm not even sure I can make loud squawks if I tried it. But there are very few of all the violin players that would be called virtuoso violinists, like Yasha Heifetz was and that sort of thing. Same, too, on ESP, that it seems to be at this stage an inherent ability. You're born with it. We've looked at the one thing that characterizes our program that we talk about in ESP Wars is that we've worked with the same psychics for over 30 years. That's just virtually never done in psychology and certainly not in parapsychology. What that gives us is a pretty good insight. Do these guys get better with practice or don't they? Can we train it or not? And the answer to both those questions is they don't get better with practice, and that's a huge mystery. I mean, I have data on, say, 7 or 8 people spanning 30 years, and they're as good as they were the day they walked in, but unfortunately no better.
Or I was going to say, are they as bad as they were from 30 years ago?
That's a tougher question, because if they were bad when they walked in the door, they didn't work with us, because we had a product we had to deliver to the government. They had to be good to begin with.
Right. But I mean, did you see any of them get a little better when they came in to when they ended?
Of course, there are certain times when they're spot on and certain other times when they're spot off. But if you look at their data, stand back and kind of squint at it over time, over 30 years, and say, what is the best line you can draw through all of this data? It's called a regression line, to be geeky for a moment. The slope of that is zero. It's just not increasing. And it's frustrating for them as well as for the researchers. Why can't they get better? We don't know. I mean, here's a wild guess. The wild guess is this. When you look at something with your regular eyes, you have a perception. You can look and say, oh, well, that's an automobile, not a goat. So you have a perception of that. However, the information that's coming through your eyes, there's something called visual acuity, and that depends upon the firmware, how good your retina is, how good your eyeglasses are, let's say, or how good your eye lenses are, and so on. You cannot do anything to improve your visual acuity. You could do a lot to improve your perception. And maybe that's where we are at the stage of ESP. We're sort of at the visual acuity, as it were, stage of understanding ESP.
What do you think, Lloyd?
I think Ed's right. You know, the problem with developing psychic abilities, of course, part of it is what the aptitude is. And they had people that were tested and worked through, so they kind of let them hit the ground running at a certain level. But if we just took average people who have had experiences, we probably could develop those folks to be better than they were when we started working with them, simply because they hadn't ever tried, or they hadn't actually even thought to point their attention to the kinds of information that they were getting psychically. You know, a lot of it's about noticing and attending to the information we get through our perceptions and sifting that out from our normal perceptions and from the guesswork we make and things like that. So it depends on who you're dealing with. But you have to kind of ask the question, did Leonardo da Vinci ever put out any clunkers? And the answer to that is probably yes. Did he get better or just simply change his style throughout his life, you know? And do athletes, you know, at some level they get better and better and better, but they never get perfect. And then they start declining because we all get old.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, with Lloyd Auerbach, whom you just heard, and Ed May. Go ahead, Ed.
Just a quick example of that. We had a woman work with us named Hella Hammett, the late Hella Hammett. She was a professional photographer, and she joined our group because she was absolutely certain she had no psychic ability, and she volunteered as a control person, you know, to compare good psychics with her. Turns out she was a magnificent psychic. She had no idea she was.
Ed, did the Soviets ever reveal to us later on the kinds of things they were looking for or what they wanted?
Well, very similar to our program, they were less interested in research. They had a job to do, spy on us. We had a job to do, spy on them. And it was terribly frustrating for both sides here, because the scientists that were involved in that work said, hey, come on, give us some money. We need to figure out how this works. And they said, no, we want to spy on the other guys. And from about 1972 in the U.S. up to about 1985, and there were some exceptions to this, we had almost no money at all to do basic research to figure out how it works. We were in the business of spying. We were in the business of trying to figure out how to make the remote viewing work better than it apparently was doing at the time. But no one said, hey, here's a pile of money. Go figure out how it worked. In 1985, I landed a $10 million contract with the Army. 85% of that was able to be spent on actual basic research, and we made huge progress at that time. We had 12 full-time researchers across many disciplines trying to figure out how this works.
That is huge.
Same problem in the Soviet Union, by the way. They did not have money for research either.
So who disbanded first, the Soviets or us?
We did. There's a long, interesting story there. Our program was shut down in 1985 for a variety of interesting reasons. The Soviets carried on. They had a group called, their military group was called 10,003, a nice romantic name like that. But it was a super secret program for remote viewers. They had 128 psychics working for the military in those days. And what's very interesting, and that was run by General Alexei Savin. And if you look in our book on page 206, what they did was to have their psychics go through military training, including hand-to-hand combat and weapons training. So I asked General Savin, hey, General Savin, what don't you understand about remote and remote viewing? You don't need to take these people. They all went to Chechnya. They were involved in the Chechnya campaign, which happened long after our program shut down. And Savin said, well, there's nothing but nothing to focus a psychic better than combat. I thought, uh-oh. Our people wouldn't have stood for it at all.
Well, how true that is. Lloyd, you've done a lot of work in the area of ghosts as well. I want to touch on some of that next hour with you and with Ed as well. Ed, so in terms of what is going on right now in our country, I mean, can you really accurately say that you're convinced that the government is no longer involved in any kind of ESP work?
I'm definitely convinced that's the case because after the Stargate program closed, a colleague and I spent an entire decade, George, on our own money, running back and forth to Washington. We had talked to the head of the intelligence for the Navy in the Pacific. There were lots of interest, and the people at the working level, the folks who would actually use our product, particularly in the era of counterterrorism, were very interested in getting something going. But at every single turn, it was killed in the boardroom, if you will, at higher-level management, higher-level officers across the military. They just were terrified here in the West, as Lloyd put it, the giggle factor. Let me give you one example.
Sure.
In the book, we talk a great deal about very high-level people in the Soviet Union who supported their work. The remote viewing group reported to what is our equivalent of the head of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We have the same level of support here, all the way reaching into the West Wing of the White House, agency directors, senators, senator staffers, high people placed in the House of Representatives, all kinds of very high-level people, and they will not allow me to use their names in print or to mention them on the air. They are just so frightened of the fact, for good reason, I suspect, of the way their names would be dragged through the mud. If you recall, a number of years ago, Nancy Reagan was expressed interest publicly in astrology.
Yeah, she loved
that. And my goodness, the press clobbered her for it.
Yeah, she truly did. She thought the world of that. Go ahead, Lloyd.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, when we talk about the government doing research, you know, the FBI has said that they've never worked with psychics, and yet that's the official statement, and probably officially they never have. So officially the FBI hasn't, but individual FBI agents may have. And in fact, one of my first jobs in parapsychology was working at the American Society for Psychical Research back in the early 80s. And I was working in the education department, and we had a psychic that was a research subject by the name of Alex Tanis, who would fly down from Maine, where he lived, every couple of weeks and spend a week there and do some work in the laboratory. And every week he was down, someone from either the FBI, Boston PD, NYPD, or some other law enforcement agency would show up to talk to Alex. And he wasn't to talk about what his work was or what the cases were, and they weren't going to admit that they ever worked with him. So, you know, is that government involvement or not? And the answer is it's not paid government involvement, it's not overt government involvement, but people from the government may still consult people.
Well, it's even more detailed than that. The chief remote viewing spy for the federal government is Mr. Joseph McMonagle. He was a warrant officer in the United States Army. He performed so well that he was given what's called the Legion of Merit Award, which is rarely given out to non-commissioned officers. But he was given that award for his excellence in remote viewing spying. And in that, in their citation, which is public, they list all the agencies which were, in fact, end users, customers of the remote viewing. So what Lloyd was saying, that the FBI certainly didn't have a program within the FBI to study psychics, but they sure as heck used it. The FBI, all the three-letter people you can think of, NSA, CIA, the Secret Service, and the list goes on and on and on, of people who actually used the product and were really quite happy with it. Now, is ESP spying the end-all? Of course not. And we failed most of the time. 80% of the time, it didn't work very well. But that 20% of the time, it worked spectacularly well and kept the customers coming back.
All right, well, let's talk about the ESP as a weapon when we come back. Plus, we'll get into some discussions about ghosts. Lloyd Auerbach with us, Ed May. Both of their websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. And just simply fire away. Don't forget also to download our free apps in our store for your iPhone or for your Android. Just take advantage of it. They are free.